Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Welcome, dear listeners, to New Dimensions Radio. Today, we explore the possibilities of making joyful choices around our exercise and eating decisions that can lead to sustainable change. Despite our strongest intentions, there are common reasons why we may find ourselves defeated in our efforts. And yet, by exploring these areas with a new framework, we can find ourselves able to finally achieve such goals. Joining us today is Michelle Seeger, PhD, an award-winning researcher emphasizing how to adopt self-care behaviors in ways that bring meaning and joy and can be sustained within the unpredictability of the real world. She advises the World Health Organization on global physical activity initiatives and is the author of the award-winning books No Sweat and The Joy Choice. Michelle's combination of academic research and real-world sustainable initiatives allow her to work with large agencies as well as individuals on their journey. Join us for the next hour as we delve into the joyful possibilities of reorienting our relationship to eating and exercise. I'm your host, Travis Glenn Sabera. Welcome to New Dimensions. And a warm welcome to you, Michelle.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
You've been studying how to create sustainable, healthy lifestyles for 30 years. And I'm wondering how young you remember as a girl, maybe growing up, that you had some interest or sense that this might be your calling in what you have to offer the world.
Actually, when you look back at your life and you see threads that you didn't know existed at the time, it's really interesting. So I'll tell you the first, not the first, but maybe the most dominant thread. And it was in 1994 when I was conducting focus groups among cancer survivors in an exercise study that I had just conducted with help with my mentors as a master's in kinesiology. And we were looking to see if exercise could help people feel better, people who were about 4.5 years out after having been treated for cancer, you know, feel better mentally through lower depressive and anxiety symptoms. And so we did our randomized controlled study, which is the gold standard. Our hypothesis pretty much were borne out in terms of exercise helping people with these symptomatologies. But fortunately, I had a mentor who said, Michelle, we have to build in some focus group qualitative research. And so the study ended. We were conducting these focus groups about 3 months after the study had ended. And the participants were sitting around, smiling, talking about exercise. And as this was my first real study, and so I was standing up tall thinking, we didn't just do good research. We really helped people in their real lives. But I found out I was wrong, because almost everyone had stopped exercising when our study ended, you know, 3 months before. And so I was very curious, well, why did you stop exercising? And they said, Michelle, have you got all day to hear why I can't exercise? I've got this, that, and the other. I work, I have a family, I have aging parents. I don't have time for exercising. I can't stay motivated with all of these other things in my life. And it dawned on me that if people who had faced a life-threatening illness didn't have the mindset and skill set to prioritize their own self-care through exercising, then we had a real problem in society. And I'm one of these really fortunate people who literally had a light bulb go off in their brain. And I knew that that was my problem and I was going to solve it. So that purpose has really driven me over the last 30 years, you know, through lots of forks in the road, getting a couple more graduate degrees, and most importantly, working with people in real life to see how do these theories pan out.
I really appreciate hearing that that aha moment happened right there, observing people at the utmost crisis point in a life. Something is blocking us from making these changes. And so I'm glad that you and your mentor had the insight, the aha, and also the capacity to further delve into this, because most people have their aha moments at these crisis points, and yet they weren't getting it to themselves. So your reflection on that seems so useful as a contribution to them and what you're doing.
Well, you know, we have to listen. Researchers were really, were taught to think about theories and to analyze the data and use the right statistical analyses. But if we don't listen to the more implicit, softer narrative that's going on beneath the data, then we're really maybe missing out on the most important things. So, you know, it's exciting to learn things you don't expect to.
So you write about an old story of behavioral change and why that may be problematic. And I'm wondering, was that what this research showed you at that time?
That research was more about a need in society. No, I think the old story of behavior change is a big problem, because we've been socialized for decades to believe it's true. And the old story of behavior change is made up of very logical behavior change strategies, such as, if we only had more willpower, we could be successful. Or wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to think about our exercise and eating choices because they were an automatic habit that we didn't have to exert thought or effort to achieve? And what has happened is that these things that make common sense and these things that potentially a minority or the outliers who are successful using them actually do use, we've been told that we should all be successful using these types of things. But the old story of behavior change is not based on the realities of the complex lives that most people live.
Exactly.
So I think it's really important to put it out there to see, do people resonate with the idea? Do you think that you should be able to adopt these strategies, but just seem to have trouble doing it? The reason why isn't people's fault. It's because we've been taught to focus on strategies that most people can't succeed long term with.
I think this is a great question, as I'm asking myself, and our listeners can ask themselves, where are we in this spectrum? And you name two types of people, I guess, a habiter and an unhabiter.
Yes. So that was a fun concept that I made up. So it's not based on empirical data. Okay. It's based on the work that I've been doing and the observations that I've made. I mean, you know, that's when you straddle both research and real life, I guess you can make up tongue-in-cheek things that, you know, I find a lot of people resonate with. So let me define each of those personas. The habiter is the person with extreme willpower and discipline, and they're very organized. So things don't tend to derail their plans. And, you know, I don't know if anyone resonates with this. I resonate with it only because I live with a habiter. My husband is a real staunch habiter, and it works for him. But unhabiters tend to be a little less organized, a little less disciplined. And in addition, they also tend to manage the lives of other people and pets and households. And so it's not that a habiter can't be the primary caregiver in a house, but what happens is that people who tend to have those additional caregiving responsibilities and task managing responsibilities, and even people who manage full teams in an organization can fall into this category. You're not only managing the logistics and the challenges and the unexpected in your own life, you're managing those things for everyone and everything else in your life that you're in charge of. And so in those circumstances, habit formation, which is among the most wildly popular behavior change techniques right now, is very hard to achieve. I should define what automatic habit is, but I don't know if...
Yeah, let's address that for our listeners. What is an automatic habit?
So when I'm talking about habit formation, I'm not referring to a behavior that you fit in consistently. I'm sticking to the official definition of an automatic habit that refers to an association with an action that's automatic that your brain learns to have. So I'm going to use a really simple example to explain how this works. With flossing, whether you're a flosser first or a toothbrusher first, either way, I'm a flosser first. So, I'll use the toothbrush example. So you brush your teeth, and then as soon as you put your toothbrush down, you pick up the floss. That is an association that a lot of people make automatically. There's no effort. There's no thought. There's no decision making. You pick up the floss at step two. And then you do it, and then there's some kind of reward at the end. And it could be as mundane as feeling like you took care of business, having a clean mouth, whatever it is. And what happens is that your brain learns those associations. So again, after I brush my teeth, I don't have to think about flossing. My brain just knows to do it. And habit formation is phenomenal. And we use it. We use automatic habits and associations throughout our day all the time. The problem is that behavior change narrative, that story, has been generalized to all healthy behaviors. So shouldn't we put our exercise on automatic habits? Shouldn't we put our healthy eating on automatic habits? And if you think about the example that I gave about brushing, putting it down, picking up the floss, think about how simple that behavior is and that you're in a context where there aren't going to be a lot of interruptions in the bathroom. But if we step outside of the bathroom and we walk into our crazy busy lives with exercise or eating, we've got plans to make. We might have to change our clothes. We might have to drive. We might have to pick up kids before we do that. There are all these other circumstances that leave room for the unexpected. It's not just a one thing and down. So that's what people need to know.
I'm speaking with Michelle Seeger, author of The Joy Choice. If you want to know more about her work, you can go to michelleseeger.com. That's michelleseeger.com. Or you can get there at newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm speaking with Michelle Seeger, and we're talking about habit formation and looking at the importance of context and applying context appropriately for the different changes that we may be trying to make in life. And we're talking about the distinctions between eating and exercise. And I know in your book, you mentioned meditation also. And this seems congruent with one of my favorite books, Tom Rath, Eat, Move, Sleep. So I'm wondering if sleep hygiene falls in this conversation too.
You know, any behavior that we hope to adopt, and there are differences between stop behaviors and starting behavior, you know, adopting behaviors and stop. So I don't know that we necessarily want to go in there, but for sleep hygiene, that could be both the start and a stop behavior. We want to adopt better sleep practices. Notice I'm not saying habits because
okay.
That would be a tough one. I think there can be interference. So if we assume it's something we can put on automatic pilot, I think a lot of people will be very disappointed because there's a lot going on at night. We're tired. We might be on social media. We might be watching TV. There might be lunches to make. There might be preparations to make. So anything that has a lot of noise around it or anything, which is most behaviors, unlike flossing or putting your keys in a specific place when you walk in the door, habit formation is going to have a lot of challenge sticking.
We're just talking about the unpredictability of what life brings us, unexpected things that we can't account for.
Absolutely. So with sleep hygiene, you want to adopt maybe an earlier bedtime, and you may want to stop whatever media you might be using or socializing you might be doing. So there are a lot of different pieces. You might want to take a bath. I mean, it's more complex, I think, than necessarily we think about. As with most behavior changes, there are so many different layers. I don't want the listeners to feel overwhelmed. In fact, with the right approach, you can really streamline things. And that's why I wrote the book, The Joy Choice.
That's great. Let's actually go into the simplification that you offer. And I love the acronym TRAP, T-R-A-P, that you invite us to look at ourselves, which one of these four aspects may either help us start a new habit or actually prevent us from moving from remaining at rest into getting into motivation and action. So can you talk about the TRAP model a little bit?
Sure. We've been talking about point of decision, right? That's why habit formation is ostensibly valuable, because at the point of decision, there's no thinking. And hopefully I've established a little bit that for complicated behaviors like eating and exercise, at the point of choice, habit formation isn't really a good option for most people. So what is, and what's going to get in the way? Because sustainable change reflects making in the moment decisions right now, and now, and now, and now. And so we have to be very concerned about what's going to get us to choose that choice or to not choose it. And the things that I found in my coaching with people, as well as, you know, kind of a synthesis of the literature on this, are four things that I'm calling the decision traps. And TRAP stands for temptation, and the R stands for rebellion, accommodation, and perfection. And if you want, I'll go through each one of those briefly.
Let's do a deep dive into each of those a little bit, just so we can make sure when we look at ourselves that we're looking at the right thing. And I know on your website also, there's the quiz that that listeners can go to and see which of these four might be more prominent in themselves.
Absolutely. Before I dive into that, I just want to say you're so in tune. Self-awareness is where it's at. You cannot make a sustainable change unless you have real self-awareness about these sorts of things. So let me dive in. Temptation. Well, that word is visceral, isn't it? We see that chocolate cake that we love and we just are so tempted to go towards it. And so, or, you know, we're tempted to stay on the couch for that great show that we're watching on Netflix. And so temptation is about this visceral push and pull that we feel. And One of the things that's interesting is that there are new theories, and this is, I'm going to geek you guys out a little bit. I hope that's okay. There are new theories in both eating and exercise, specifically about eating and exercise, which is real advancement in our science, that show that how we experience these behaviors, how food feels going down our throat, what it smells like, the texture in our mouth, the flavor, the people we're with, all of these experiences basically get encoded in our brain. So when we look at that chocolate cake, we're not really looking at that chocolate cake. Our brain is remembering all the incredible past, delicious, social, connected experiences we had. And similarly with exercise, and I'm going to use a negative example because a lot of people have had very negative examples. When we're about to move or to go to the gym or to get off the couch, our brain is flooded with our past memories, often unconscious memories of past experiences, the shame we might have felt in PE, the self-consciousness and discomfort we might feel going to the gym. And so at these points of decision, temptation is fueled by these memories that are encoded in our brain. And so with that knowledge, we know we don't just say, oh, I shouldn't have that piece of cake. It's not on my eating plan. It's, oh, that cake is so tempting because of all these past experiences. And then aren't you so much better off knowing what you're up against in those situations?
I think there's a kindness in understanding this, that we're understanding it's not just my own relationship with the piece of cake. It involves the whole history of my socialization and my belonging and all of that that's tied up in everything we do. So to acknowledge this, then besides pure one-on-one willpower, is yes. So kind to bring awareness to this and to understand that our whole history is here in this now, in this new piece of cake.
And it really aligns. I mean, you're saying this, but I just want to say it out loud because my work has also been influenced. We haven't talked about this, by my own study of mindfulness and meditation practice for many, many, many years. When you look at something non-judgmentally, right, if it's not good or bad and you try to understand it, you take yourself out of the amygdala, right? You take yourself out of the emotional part of it and really have more cognitive wherewithal, if you will, to work with it. And that actually takes us to the next one. Work with it instead of rebel. We're into the rebellion disruptor. Because if we shouldn't have something, of course we want it all the more. And when we should do something, forget about it, right? So it doesn't matter that we're in our 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Deep down, there's that five-year-old who doesn't want to be told what to do, you know? And again, on the academic front, there's a theory called reactance theory that really is all about human beings are motivated to reclaim their freedom innately when it's been removed.
And there's something about this that even if it's not coming from inside of us, even if it's ourselves telling us what we should do, we're still going to rebel against that.
Absolutely. And you know, people
such
might call
a challenge.
It self-sabotage, but it's all in the frame. So we're going to get to a more optimal frame because right now we're just focusing on the decision disruptors. But rebellion is a big one because at the point of decision, if it feels like a should or a chore, then really you're innately, organically motivated to rebel against it. And you know, that doesn't set you up for the choice that you really wanted to make. So the next decision disruptor is accommodation. And this is in a slightly different category. And it actually goes back to the cancer survivors. Accommodation as a decision disruptor means that we consistently subsume our own self-care decisions and behaviors below other people and things. So for example, if we're talking about a parent, they may feel that the needs of everyone else are more important than their time for exercise. On the flip side, it could be that someone who's in a real strong leadership position feels that their work is just always, there's always something urgent, and then they never make the choice to do the meal planning that they needed to do. And so accommodation is not about taking care of others. That is a very important part of our lives, regardless of whether you're a formal caregiver or not. We take care of our friends. We volunteer. We have animals. I mean, we're caregiving, you know, a caregiving species. What accommodation as a decision disruptor is fundamentally about is about never prioritizing your own self-care needs. And that could be even, I'm not going to do the planning that I need, you know, the spend the 15 minutes planning what I'm going to get at the grocery store so I can cook the meals that I know are going to make me feel my best, you know.
As I hear both the R and the A, the rebellion and the accommodation, I'm thinking of another New Dimensions guest we had, Terry Real, who talks about something that gets us out of our presence and our choice is feeling one up or one down about something. So rebellion seems like a kind of one up principle. Accommodation seems like a one down, but they both take us out of our center.
Absolutely. And I'm a big fan of Terry's work too. So I'm glad you made that connection. And then the last one sets the stage for everything, all the other ones to happen, perfection, all or nothing thinking. If it's gotta be perfect, and perfect doesn't exist most of the time, then the only alternative is nothing at all by its very definition. So it all or nothing means we have to rebel against the rules because it's all or nothing. It means we're so tempted that there's no room for compromise because it's not about the cake. It's about the whole cake, right? It sets the stage for all of these other things to come into. It's, you know, and when it comes to accommodation, it's not about, you know, the hour walk you didn't take. It's about, well, it had to be an hour walk. So even though you only had 20 minutes because of the needs of other people that you took care of, you didn't take the 20 minutes. So you can see how these things combine together to create a big trap around our daily decisions.
And so that we might not even just have one of them, we could have a whole combination, even all four at play.
Absolutely. Though a couple people tend to really lean in towards one or two.
I'm speaking with Michelle Seeger, author of The Joy Choice. If you want to know more about her work, you can go to michelleseeger.com. That's michelleseeger.com, where you can also find her quiz to focus in on which trap is more common in your way of thinking. Or you can get there at newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation.